The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School.
On today's episode, co-hosts Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington, Lieutenant Dan Peterson, and Lieutenant Commander Elena Youngblood speak with NPS METOC PhD alum Commander Casey Gaughan, Ops Officer at CINMOC, about his unique naval career, leadership experience as CEO of the Naval Ice Center, as well as his current perspective of the METOC community in general.
Welcome back to METOC METOCs. Good afternoon from the Naval Postgraduate School campus in Monterey. Your hosts today are myself, Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington,
Lieutenant Commander Elena Youngblood,
and Lieutenant Dan Peterson.
We're all meteorology and oceanography students at NPS, and we're honored to have with us today NPS Meteorology and Oceanography graduate, the Operations Officer at Naval Meteorology and Oceanography Command, or CINMOC, Commander Casey Gaughan. He received his master's from the Naval Postgraduate School in Meteorology and Oceanography in 2013 and received his doctorate in Oceanography in 2019. Thank you, sir, for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us about the METOC community, your command, and your personal experience. We'd like to spend some time getting to know you and your experience throughout your naval service and discuss your leadership and vision of the METOC community in the future.
Wow, that's a lot. Thanks for having me. This is really awesome. Really honored to be here. It's been an interesting experience coming back to the Naval Postgraduate School. It's been actually this September will be the official payback of my 5 years from getting my PhD here. I owed the Navy 5 years of time after I graduated. So September marks 5 years, and it's the first time I've been able to come back since then and be on campus and see everybody. So it's been a really awesome day today, and I got to sit in on some thesis briefs and everything. But for me, my story starts almost 21 years ago. I joined the Naval Academy in June of 1999 after I graduated from Cheektowaga Central, which is right outside of Buffalo, New York. So go Bills, go Sabres. Diehard Bills and Sabres fan. Or my mom and my sister, brother-in-law, and niece, and most of my family still resides in Buffalo. I actually studied economics at the Naval Academy, was not an oceanography major, and I was a surface warfare officer coming out of the Naval Academy. Interestingly enough, my senior year, I applied for the ocean option, which was a little bit different than the program is now, and I didn't find out that I'd actually been selected as an ocean option until I was 6 months into my first tour on board USS Steedham, which was really funny. So I was walking down the pier one day and they gave me my letter, and it was a letter.
Wait, you're a Steedham?
I was on board USS Steedham.
Steedham.
Ah, DDG 63, Steelworker.
Yeah, when were you Steedham?
I was on Steedham from, I checked in September of 2003 until December of 2004 or 5.
I'm 9 through 11.
Very good, yeah. So I actually, I took her over to Japan. We replaced the USS Cushing, lived in Japan for about 8 months, lived on board the ship because I wasn't there for the magic year mark to live out in town. That was exciting. And then I moved back to San Diego and I took over as the navigator on board USS Germantown, LSD 42, which was a fantastic experience. It was the first time we learned about at the Naval Academy, everybody told you, you know, people are going to look at you and you need to be a leader in these things. But the thing that is ingrained in me every day, the captain of the ship would come up there and say, Nav, where are you taking my ship today? And it was a really impactful statement because to me, he trusted me to navigate his ship where it needed to go. But it was very clear to me that it was still his ship, and I had an important role in that. But he trusted me. He gave me that space to do my job every single day. And at 22 years old, that was pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. So I really, really enjoyed that experience. And then from there, I went to shore duty in Newport, Rhode Island at Officer Candidate School, where I taught navigation. And I pushed CS classes, DCEO classes, every kind of class that Officer Training Command Newport had, I pushed. And that was super fun. I took some night school classes at Salve Regina, and I got my MBA while I was on shore duty. After my MBA, I thought I was going to separate from the Navy, actually. So we bought a house and lived in Newport, just outside of Newport, Rhode Island. And that was the downturn of the economy. It was a tough time. Places weren't really hiring, and there wasn't a lot of opportunity. And I was able to execute my METOC option literally at the 5 year and 11 month point. And at that point in time, it was different, where you had up to 6 years to execute your option and then you lost your option. So at 5 years and 11 months, I became a METOC officer and they sent me straight to NPS. I was so late coming into the community, I didn't even have the opportunity to go to the basic course for oceanographers. Came here and graduated in 2013, studied under Dr. Jamie McMahon. So oceanography.
Tough route to go. But Jamie is hard because he demands a lot.
He has a high level of excellence. Yeah.
Exactly. And so he definitely pushes students to the most.
But just to reiterate, you went straight from an economics type background to master's degree in meteorology and oceanography.
And survived.
Bottom line, survived.
That's pretty hard sledding.
Yes. My first meteorology and oceanography class was at the Naval Postgraduate School. I had a bachelor's in science and economics from the Naval Academy, which qualified me to enter into the Naval Postgraduate School. It was a challenge.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's going from a different background at a completely different discipline at a very high demanding program with one of probably the toughest oceanography advisors that you could hope to assign for with Jamie. He has definitely done a lot of great work, but he demands a lot from his students. So that's not an easy route to take.
It was demanding, but it was incredibly rewarding. And I think that's a theme that I've found throughout my career is the jobs and the accomplishments that I've been able to really hold on to and cherish were always the hardest things along the way. So I think there's really a correlation there that the greatest friends I have in the organization of the Navy are the people that I went through the hardest things with. Those bonds are kind of forged in the fire, if you will. I look at Jamie the same way. I mean, he took a chance on me, right? I mean, he interviews every student that comes through there and wants to know that he's getting the kind of student he wants.
He turned me down, for the record.
I think he wishes he turned me down.
I don't know. Your name was still on the door when I got here in June of 22.
Yeah, fact. And he still speaks lovingly of you. So
Jamie's a wonderful human being, but he does push us hard. And that hard and that excellence pays off. And it's interesting because it's one of those examples here at NPS where we have this bond and this relationship with our civilian professors, but we come at it from a military perspective. And one of the things I always appreciated working with Jamie is I feel like he works hard like we do in the uniform, just in his world. And so the work ethic that's required to be in his office is what's required of us as naval oceanographers everywhere we go. And that experience was so good. After I went to the Weather Center and out to sea on board Kearsarge, I came back to get my PhD with Jamie as well, which was by far the hardest thing I've ever done. I've done a lot of hard things in life, whether it's been in the Navy, personal side of my life, or professionally, but the PhD was hands down the most difficult thing that I've ever done in my life.
And I will say this about Jamie. He does have the ability to kind of distinguish your aptitude for being able to cover the ground that needs to be covered. And when he turned me down, it was not because he didn't value what I was interested in. It was because he saw that the time horizon and the things that I needed to accomplish and my family just simply didn't add up. And so it was a very professional decision from his behalf in my self-interest to be able to kind of protect those things and make sure that I was able to continue on with achieving what I needed to do here at NPS.
And think about the simple fact of that lesson there that you get to carry forward with you as you go and lead in the Navy now when you have junior sailors and junior officers and chiefs and senior officers that you're working for. That was a really hard, honest conversation. And we're charged to do those things. And those conversations are harder and more common the longer you stick around and the more senior you get. So that perspective that he shared with you and provided you and giving you that space in a professional, respectful way is something that I hope you're able to carry with you.
Oh, 100%. We still have a great relationship together. And it was, you know, him protecting me against myself. And I had to kind of self-evaluate that and take it back on my own terms and kind of say, you know what, Dan, he's right. Even though, you know, I'd hoped otherwise, but at the same time, it's kind of the lessons that we learned that are important.
You know, and it's a beautiful thing with working with a guy like Jamie. Some of the biggest breakthroughs we had were not necessarily in the office. So Jamie has a propensity to fun activities. He's an avid mountain biker, avid surfer. And the man's brain just doesn't turn off. He is able, he's one of the few people that I've met that is able to be present with you personally in the moment, but is just processing in the background and thinking about everybody else's project. And for as demanding as he is and the high standard that he has, he gives you more than we ever give him of himself. And his family has been incredible watching him grow his own career. And I just remember there'd be times that we'd be out mountain biking on a weekend and we would stop to catch our breath and he'd be like, hey, what do you think about this? You know what I mean? And I'm like, Oh, I thought that trail we did is awesome. I really wasn't thinking about my project. And we'd have a breakthrough and it would be, hey, let's try that. Let's look into this, you know, or go find a paper on that and read about it and see that. And so that level of commitment from your advisor, I'm especially grateful for that.
Yeah, I think that civilian military relationship is critically important as we kind of move forward in time and progress. To be able to have those kind of relationships is just critical to our success, I mean, honestly.
And you can parlay that into this special makeup of our community is METOC, or Meteorology and Oceanography for the Navy, a very small community highlighted by officers, chiefs, and sailors, or just all of us as sailors in uniform, but then our incredible civil servants and contractors that make this go around. And that's just the defined portion of the METOC community. That doesn't talk about our relationships with industry, our relationships with academia, with the applied physics labs, whether it's Johns Hopkins or any of them. I mean, we have this amazing community. I had the pleasure of the last 2 days to sit at the Naval Research Lab and take in the research development and technology evaluation reviews for what's called the 6-4 reviews. And the 6-4 reviews are the scientists that are transitioning science into operations and giving us capabilities, bringing on our latest models for the atmosphere in this case, or ensembles and tools that we need every day. And you sit there and look at the remarkable work these people are doing. One of the presentations we got yesterday was on tropical cyclone forecasting and the latest advancements in tropical cyclone forecasting. They're able to reduce the error circles by 15%. 15%. We're talking about the decision to evacuate someplace or not evacuate someplace, whether someplace is going to be destroyed or not be able to be destroyed, and the financials that go with that in those communities. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And these things are happening right here at NRL Monterey. And that partnership is so important with the civil servants. It's amazing. We're really lucky.
So you graduated after your PhD. What did you get into after your second tour at NPS?
I was fortunate enough while I was at NPS to screen for command. But before I had the opportunity to go to command, I had the opportunity to go to a milestone job. So I was the Fleet Oceanographer and the Maritime Operations Center Executive Officer at the 5th Fleet, quartered in Bahrain. And I was out there for about 18 months. It was a very dynamic time. I got out there around Thanksgiving in 2019 and left in the spring of 2021. So in there is a very interesting time, right? COVID. And Colleen, it's really awesome to see you again because first met you at the Ice Center when I came back from 5th Fleet. And what we accomplished in 5th Fleet was pretty dynamic. Soleimani was killed by the U.S. government during that time. And that changed the Middle East dramatically, and we were preparing for war. We were preparing for our headquarters to be targeted, trying to figure out how to get the families and their pets and all their stuff out of there. And it really hit home when they were going through at the headquarters and saying, you know, hey, who do you have available that can be identified to go out on teams to look for family members and sailors from the headquarters after we get hit? You know, unfortunately that didn't happen, but some army bases in Iraq weren't so lucky. So those were the things that were going on there. It was a pretty dynamic time. And that was during COVID. And we didn't have the opportunity or the option to stop working. So we had to look for different ways and creative ways to work. And that staff worked 7 days a week under the leadership of now Admiral Paparo, soon to be a PACOM commander. And it was a challenge. We had to figure out how to get the vaccine deployed to the ships and to our people out there. And that became a mission. Readiness became the mission. And that was really hard. So I left the 5th Fleet. And I had the opportunity to take command of the National Naval Ice Center in Suitland, Maryland, where I met Colleen. And that was the other end of the spectrum. We were in a NOAA building. It's a tri-agency organization made up of NOAA, Coast Guard, and the Navy. And it's a civilian, heavy civilian workforce with a small military footprint with a big mission to predict ice in the Arctic, the Antarctic, the Great Lakes, and wherever else the Navy thinks it's important to support operations. And they took a different approach during COVID. They were a bit more risk averse. NOAA, we were in a NOAA building and a NOAA facility, and NOAA is very risk averse. We didn't have that option in 5th Fleet. So we went from a 7-day work week calendar in 5th Fleet to people teleworking, 3 days a week, and minimizing the amount of staff in office to protect people, which was a different way to look at readiness and maintain that protection. And it was turbulent. I think Colleen can relate because she was at the brunt of my, where is everybody? What are we doing? What do you mean I'm not going to meet everybody for the first 2 months I'm in the seat? I'm the commanding officer. How am I going to get to know my team? Why am I talking to people on a TV screen? And just kind of having this moment of what is going on?
A transition.
Adapt and adjust. The military is definitely get the mission done. That those partnerships are critically important. And so it plays a very challenging role when you have to interact in different policies and the way that they kind of mesh. And I think, you know, you're talking about some of the ways that civilians versus military operate because of the risk that the military is willing to accept in these challenging roles. And so, you know, that creates a challenge in itself, especially in a leadership position, taking over that position at NAVICE. And I think the critical importance is still there. I mean, NORTHCOM just released their policy on the Arctic, and it highlights the importance and the critical roles that are filled by NAVICE.
The ICE Center is incredibly strategic in what they do. The aha moment that I had was a little bit later in command, but I had an opportunity to go to Argentina to represent the National ICE Center at the International ICE Charting Working Group, which is a large meeting that moves around the world. And all the partners, I think it's over 20 countries, are part of the group, and they get together. And the very first 2 days or day and a half of the meeting, everybody gives an update on what they're doing at their individual ICE center. So the U.S. got to go. And that, just saying what I just said, was a moment for me. The U.S. got to go and I got to get up and speak. It was a very humbling moment. And I talked about all the great work that we were doing and the things that we're concerned about. And I didn't think much of it. And my 10-minute talk was over and I moved on and I sat down. Well, the next country gets up and they talk about all the great work they're doing and they flash up a product from the National ICE Center. That's our product that's created, and all the products that they created from our product. And then the next country gets up and starts briefing about all the great work that they're doing in their country at their ICE center, and they flash up a product from the National ICE Center and all the products they were able to create from the National ICE Center. And the next country, and the next country, and the next country. It was this moment where I did not appreciate where we stood on the world stage legitimately with the work that those folks did every day. I knew they did great work. I knew they were committed. I knew they were awesome Americans. And they come to work, and they worked hard, and they did their job. But what I didn't understand is where that fit in the context of the global ICE community, frankly. And it truly is the gold standard. It's a point of pride that took me all too long, frankly, to get my head wrapped around in command. I mean, that was over halfway through my tour as a CO. And I sometimes lay awake at night and think, you know, if I had had that perspective earlier on in my time in the seat, how would that have changed maybe the way I went about running my command or how we did things or how we had the opportunity to present what the team was doing and working on and what opportunities maybe we missed because I just didn't have that understanding.
I think there's a lot to be said for the quiet professionals that make things happen in the background and kind of leadership roles that we fill. And, you know, I think every one of us in this room has had that opportunity, that humbling opportunity to kind of recognize after, oh my gosh, that's what we were doing and the importance that it plays on the international community, not just the U.S. role. It's really fascinating to kind of hear from the skipper's perspective of how things went and truly humbling to kind of hear that as well. So after the ICE Center, where did you go next?
Admiral Pratt gave me a challenge. Wonderful human being. But he asked me to do one of the hardest things I had to do. As a small community, we talk about the daisy chain. And for those of you who don't know what the daisy chain is the entire METOC wardroom or meteorology and oceanography wardroom is about the size of a guided missile destroyer crew. So about 330 people. And the higher up in that little pyramid you go, the fewer people there are. So when you move one person, the next person has to move and the next person. And there's third and fourth order effects of moving people around when you move people. And we had to move people. It was that time of year that we had to get people into command and other people to command and other people out to sea and those things. Admiral Pratt had a really hard decision to make that we had to shut down one of our Echelon 5 commands. And the command that was chose to shut down is the Fleet Survey Team, which has an incredible mission. It's still a very valid mission, and we still have the capability, frankly, at the Mine Warfare Center and at the Naval Oceanographic Office now. But we don't have the capacity that we once did when we had its own command. And the thing about shutting that command down was that was the prize command. That was the command everybody that came into the community wanted to go be a part of. Everybody wanted to be part of Fleet Survey Team.
Can you give a quick spiel as to what the Fleet Survey Team did, just for those that don't know?
Yeah, they had the coolest toys.
Yeah. Coolest mission. There's a lot of things that come with that, especially at the JO level. Like there's academic capabilities, international capabilities, the ability to interact with foreign countries. I mean, It's a really unique kind of mission set.
The fleet survey team had a global mission to do what's called hydrography, or survey the bottom near the land, however they could, to ultimately update navigation charts or provide key elements of information to give access to maybe Marines landing on a beach, or whether it's safe for a ship to go in a port, or whatever the case may be. So that's what they did, and they did it all over the world. The piece that was amazing about what that command did is we sent junior officers and young sailors all over the world to do this, unsupervised, with our international partners. And we taught a lot of our international partners how to survey, or when we were done helping them survey, we provided them the data so they can update their own navigation charts. And those relationships are key. If you look at the world today and the way things are going and what's important to the current administration, our partnerships are in every piece of guidance that's being released from the U.S. government about how we need to work and operate. And that command did those things every day with our most junior people, frankly, around the world and unsupervised in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think one of the most incredible pieces of that was back in 2008, we had a pretty historic earthquake that happened in Haiti, and we needed to supply humanitarian aid. And before we could do any of those things, we sent out the fleet survey team to survey the port that was critical for providing aid, and we're able to do so. And then, you know, as in today's world, as we're looking at Haiti and how we operate and how we support them in the Caribbean, fleet survey team provided a critical piece of information in that environment to be able to execute those operations. So huge capability.
Just incredible stuff. And I had to shut it down. Thankfully, Commander Jen Landry did a lot of the work to get us to a point, and she handed me off just an incredible package. But it didn't take away the fact that we're shutting down in a lot of people's minds the prize jewel of the community. And that was hard to do. It was emotional for a lot of people, but it was necessary for where we're going and what we need to do. And like I said, we're able to maintain the capability. We just lost some capacity along the way. So that's what I did after the ICE Center. And then I finally had the opportunity to get to the job I'm in now. And I'm the operations officer at the headquarters of Navy Meteorology and Oceanography.
What is the scope of your current position?
The way I like to explain it to people is I am part of a Maritime Operations Center, which is made up of operations, intelligence, and international programs. Most Maritime Operations Centers have a regional focus. So I was in the 5th Fleet MOC, which only worried about the 5th Fleet part of the world, or the 7th Fleet MOC. The only other MOC that I'm tracking that has a global mission set is 10th Fleet. So I get to be the Operations Center for the global mission set of meteorology and oceanography. And it's a difficult mission because, as we have already discussed, we're such a small community and we have to cover the globe. And we have METOC personnel inside Task Group 80.7, which is our operational commander umbrella of meteorology and oceanography. And then we have folks that are stationed with the staffs and embedded with those staffs that we have to liaise with to help them get the whole of the Task Group 80.7 to them to help, frankly, inform decisions for their commanders.
Which I think the important part is the partnership piece that you mentioned as well. Yeah, I'm coming off of the Global Mine Warfare staff, where we had a similar AOR of covering the globe. And our ability to execute our mission was only possible through our relationship with CINMOC MOC on how we execute missions, because the information that was provided is critically important to operations that are happening globally. So, you know, it's those partnerships between those different entities that are hugely important. And I could put it in small terms, but, you know, they have a significant impact on how we operate and the decisions that we make, you know, and you can read it in the headlines in the news. It's pretty important and pretty awesome to see that mission and the partnerships kind of working together.
Behind every operation we see in the news, there is some element of meteorology or oceanography that is happening, period. From the seabed to the stars, as we like to say. And it's true. You watch what's going on in the 5th Fleet with the strikes from the Houthis on the tankers. You watch what's going on in the Ukraine. While we're not directly involved in the Ukraine conflict, we're watching it and understanding the environment in case something like that would have to escalate. The Israeli conflict, we're deeply involved in what's going on and how to contribute in understanding the environment to better than our adversary, to provide our commanders the opportunity to make better, smarter, faster decisions than our competitors is what we do. And we do it really well. We do it every day.
All I can think of right now is that big poster that our public affairs team, the METOC public affairs team, has been putting together the last couple of years with the little images of all the different operations that we did across the world. Did you ever think when you executed your option that you would have had a hand at every single one of those dots?
It's funny. That is a really powerful graphic, and maybe there's a way we can figure out how to push that out. I can take that back for action to our public affairs officer. But what gets me in the current seat that I'm in, Colleen, is when you look at the bottom of that graphic is the numbers, the number of miles we surveyed, the number of forecasts we provided, those numbers. And it's the growth from 2022 to 2023 in that. What that says to me is people are starting to understand that the weather is important, the oceanography is important, that we can help make those decisions better and smarter. And maybe we can save more mission if we ask the weather team, or if the weather team is more involved is maybe another way to say it and look at it. If we reach in and say, hey, let me help you out, let me show you this. If we did this, or if we did that, or did you know maybe our radars could see better over here than their radars can see over there, or those kinds of things are the things that we can do to help make better decisions or give the information to our commanders to make better decisions.
I think a critical part of that is talking about what technology development is happening in the world around us between academia and industry, especially with machine learning and AI. And so learning how that piece of the puzzle kind of fits into the meteorology and oceanography community, I think, is critically important on how we operate in the future. So what are some of the things that the community might be doing to kind of leverage those capabilities?
So one of the neat things I've had the opportunity to do since I was in command and now is we get to work with industry. And so while we're at the Ice Center, we help get what's called a Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, or a CRADA, with SOFAR Ocean, which is located up in San Francisco. And they're sensing the ocean. They put buoys all over the world. And their main mission area is to help merchants get where they need to go more efficiently. And they help define what that mission is for efficiency. But that's what they do for the merchant community. There's opportunities for us just understanding the products they provide from the wave heights and those things, and partnering with how they go about their mission and the differences on how they do ship routing versus we do ship routing, and that cooperative partnership. And what I like to talk about here is that is, to me, the modern day Rosie the Riveter. I don't know that we'll be able to create the shipbuilding machine and the airplane building machine that we had during World War II. So how do we maintain our competitive advantage? And I look for these exquisite opportunities to work with industry to develop these partnerships so we can get smarter and maybe leverage what they're doing, but in turn, grow our understanding and how we might be able to use what they're doing as well. And I think that partnership is critical.
I completely agree. That was the first stop when I started my research here at NPS, was stopping by SOFAR and meeting with Peter Smith and his team. And they're doing amazing work up there at their ability to sense the oceanographic environment, especially with the buoy systems that they're developing and their ability to cover the globe. I mean, it's incredible. So those partnerships are critical.
And we can learn from that. We can learn on how they're doing it and figure out other networks are effective to get sensors in where they want to get them in. And there's things we have opportunities to learn from them, and they have opportunities to learn from us.
Well, sir, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule. I know we need to usher you off to another meeting. I didn't really ask very many questions because you hit nearly every single wicket as I was like, oh, I'm going to ask this question, and nope, he got it. It's always great working with you, sir, and listening to your experience and taking some of that insight back that we can apply here at NPS in our own careers. Without further ado.
Just one follow-up question. What advice can you give to college graduates who are looking for opportunities in the career force? How does education translate to operations and future progress?
Everything we're doing here at NPS, everything we do in our undergraduate degree, is about gaining education and understanding and diving deep into hard problems. And that ability to look at a problem different than somebody else who may not have that experience is huge and key. And us as leaders have to provide that space for our sailors and our civilians to use their brains and get after the hard problems and let them experience the ups and downs as we can inside that bounded box of operations to get after the hard problems. The old guys like me are not going to necessarily figure it out. But what I can do is I can create space for the smart folks like you and our sailors to get after these hard problems and bring us really neat solutions. And so to anybody that's thinking about a career in STEM, you should think about joining the Navy. You should think about Navy meteorology and oceanography. We have incredible opportunities. And whether it's from a civil servant perspective or as a uniformed member, you can join a better community. And I'll take it one step further, is you can join a better family. And that is one thing that is truly unique about the Metok community versus any other community I've met in the Navy is we are truly a family.
Thanks for listening to Metok Metoks.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.